close to finishing this. So let me pull this up to... Yeah, here's a verse in Ecclesiastes 8:17. That's the last passage we looked at in Ecclesiastes. There are three passages. I saw all that God has done, despite all his efforts to search it out. Man cannot discover its meaning. Even if a wise man claims he knows, he cannot really comprehend it. And the point we drew from this is, this text is telling us we can never completely understand all of the elegance and the purpose and the design that God reveals through the record of nature. In other words, the intelligent design project will never come to an end. No matter how much effort we put into it, there's always more to discover about the handiwork of God. And, you know, I'm somewhat of a critic of intelligent design, as you'll see when you read the book Creation of Science, namely that we need to do a lot more than just simply say there's an intelligent designer out there. The record of nature, as we saw in previous texts in Ecclesiastes, actually is powerful enough not to just simply reveal that there's a designer out there, but to identify the personal characteristics of this designer. In other words, we can tell that it's not just an intelligent designer, but a supernatural designer. And as we'll see in the text we're looking at today, we can tell that he is kind and generous and loving and wise, gracious, etc. So it's not just simply some ill-defined intelligent designer. The record of nature gives us a more detailed revelation. And Ecclesiastes is probably one of the places you can go in the Bible that makes that point, that there is this detailed revelation, and it's unfathomable. The more you study it, the more evidence you're going to find for this Creator, and the more details you're going to be able to discern from the record of nature about who this Creator is and what he has done. So we're never going to plumb the depths of the purpose and the design and the elegance of God's creation. The more we study, the more we'll discover. All right, Habakkuk. The earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord. And the interpretation I put on this, and you guys helped me with this, is that the study of creation increasingly will reveal God's glory to all of humanity. The more we study, the more we're going to discover. So it's similar to the theme we see in the Ecclesiastes. And this is something we demonstrate on our website at reasons.org. Every day we post a brand new discovery from the record of nature that gives us more evidence for the God of the Bible. You'll see it in our home page. It's called Today's New Reason to Believe. And by the way, if you want that as a free daily email, just sign up. Every day you can get an email from us. And this is neat because you can pass it on through the email network of your office so that all of your colleagues every day get a brand new reason to believe. Whether they want one or not, they'll get a brand new reason to believe. Well, the whole point is, you know, their curiosity will be rubbed on one or the other. They may ignore 75% of them, but hey, if they just get 25%, that will help. So we encourage you to take advantage of that. And Habakkuk 2:14 assures all of us have reasons to believe that we're going to be able to keep this up until the Lord returns. We have no doubt whatsoever that we're going to run out of discoveries to report. Habakkuk tells us the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord. All we got to do is look, and we're going to find this. His glory covered the heavens, and his praise filled the earth. Habakkuk 3:3. A lot of ways this can be interpreted, but one interpretation I suggested last of time we looked at this 2 weeks ago, his glory covered the heavens and his praise filled the earth. It doesn't matter where you look, you're going to find this evidence for God revealed through the record of nature. Now, sometimes audiences come up to me and say, is it just astrophysics and biochemistry that's revealing all this phenomenal evidence? And our response is, well, that's what we're talking about today, and this is what people are probably most aware of, but the truth is, pick any discipline of science. Geology, anthropology, chemistry, zoology, anthropology, it just doesn't matter. Any discipline you want, even sociology, and you're going to find these evidences for God and his handiwork. It's everywhere. And this is something that is one of the goals we have at Reasons to Believe, is to develop a comprehensive enough scholar team that we could actually cover all the disciplines of knowledge and show people how in all these different disciplines we're seeing this increasing revelation of God's glory and God's handiwork. So, yeah, we're kind of specializing in a few disciplines, the ones that we think are most productive. But the truth is, go anywhere. And, hey, we got John Traeger speaking in a couple of weeks. He's a botanist. And he can tell you that in botany, it's the same situation. As you look, you keep finding these new evidences for the God of the Bible. So you can talk to John. Now, moving into the book of Acts. It's interesting that the Apostle Paul in Acts 14, this is kind of his introduction to the evangelistic message that he gives to the gathered unbelievers. And I find it fascinating. He starts off his appeal for people to consider what Jesus Christ has offered. And he makes the point, referring to God, that he has not left himself without testimony. He has shown kindness by giving you rain from heaven and crops in their seasons. He provides you with plenty of food and fills your hearts with joy. Now, here he is talking to an assembled audience of unbelievers who have never heard of Jesus Christ. But he starts off by saying, we know, all of us know, there is a God. And he says, how do you know? This God has not left himself without testimony. Look at the crops he has provided. How can you explain the existence of the abundance of the crops that you're gathering from your agricultural fields unless there is a God, and not only just any God, but a God who is kind and generous towards the human species? Now, just step back a minute. I mean, this was stated by Paul 2,000 years ago, but I think this is even more evident today. You know, you've got naturalists and atheists trying to explain why the planet looks the way it does. How can you explain from a naturalistic perspective why the plants of the field produce such an abundance of food for the animals and especially for us? Why all this productivity? I mean, from an evolutionary perspective, what's in it for the plants? I mean, what benefit does a plant get from overproducing all this plentitude? You can say, well, the plants do get some benefit. I've heard evolutionists talk about the fact, well, I mean, you've got raspberries, and the bears eat the raspberries, and they defecate the seeds, and that means more raspberries. So the raspberries, do benefit. However, the raspberries don't have to produce quite so many raspberries to get the job done. They can distribute their seeds with a lot fewer raspberries. Moreover, they don't have to produce so much food around that seed. I mean, they could get the bears. I mean, I've watched bears eat. They'll eat anything. So you don't have to give them quite such a luscious berry for them to get those seeds well distributed. But the point is, there's a God out there who's kind to the bears, who's kind to humanity, and creates these plants that produce far beyond what evolution can possibly explain. I mean, you look at what we get from cows, what we get from wheat. I mean, everything is overproducing food far beyond what a naturalistic explanation would allow. And then you look at how God has designed certain plants and animals, and you compare with what they were in the beginning, in the sense that how much milk did cows produce before human beings got a hold of cows? Okay? It was a few quarts a day. Well, a good dairy cow can now produce about 90 quarts a day. Now, if you have that cow out there producing 90 quarts, it's going to cause problems for the calves. And it's going to cause problems, because a calf can't absorb that kind of milk. And, my dad worked on a dairy farm for 3 years. And it says, if you are late on milking those cows are a real pain. And they start squawking. They demand that they be milked because that milk is just, they're producing so much milk. It causes them a lot of physical trauma. They have to be milked. But the whole point is, look at the incredible design in the cow. That here's a cow that God designed to provide milk for his calves. And your typical cow has one calf at a time. And so that one calf doesn't need that much milk, but God designed the cow in such a way that it could be bred to produce 90 quarts of milk a day. Now, we're not just talking cows. What was wild corn like? Again, we can get John up here and talk to us about corn. Maybe we can get him to give a lecture about corn here. But, corn is one of the amazing stories. How the original wild corn had a few scrawny kernels on it per, what do they call that thing that the cob. Yeah, the cob, all right. It only had a few scrawny kernels per cob. And now what does a cob produce? I mean, you know, hundreds of kernels, nice, fat, nutritious. And we've been able to breed corn so that it could produce at that high of a level. Well, if you're trying to explain that from a naturalistic perspective, what would there be in a naturalistic model, an explanation for why we can do that with corn, why we can do that with cows and all the other animals and plants that we domesticate? I mean, look at the productivity of wheat compared to what it was before it got domesticated. And this is the point that Paul is making here. Now, even to people without a lot of scientific knowledge, he says, hey, this is a kind creator who's given us this huge abundance. And you say, well, what about all the famines? Well, famines do take place. But the whole point is that, you know, it's feast or famine. Kind of the story you see in the book of Genesis, how there were seven plentiful years followed by 7 years of famine. In other words, God has caused these plants to produce at such an extremely high level that we can literally store up food for those times when the rainfall isn't intense. And for that matter, who really is responsible for the famines on this planet? Most of the famines that have taken place in human history have been a direct result of human abuse, not the fact that the seasons weren't what they could be. But this is another testimony of design. I mean, why is it that we can store wheat for 20 years and it's still good to eat? I mean, that was the pride of Babylon. They had this enormous city of Nebuchadnezzar with these huge walls, walls that were so thick and so high that anything less than a World War I army would have no opportunity to penetrate those walls. And then when the Persians were outside, they said, forget you, we have a 20-year supply of grain inside the city, we have abundant water, and we think we can wait you out. And such that they were able to have their army down in Arabia and not even worry about the Persians. Of course, the Persians found another way to get inside the city. They went under the walls instead of over the walls and diverted the river, an engineering project. But the whole point is, you know, how can you explain from a naturalistic perspective why we're able to store food as long as we're able to store it? And, you know, wheat is not just the only example, but, you know, we can literally keep these things in that condition for that period of time. Again, what's in it for the rice, what's in it for the wheat that it has these qualities? So the magnitude and quality of God's provision provides existence, evidence for his existence and character. And it not only tells us that he exists, it tells us, at least with respect to the human species, he's very kind and very generous. And what we see, actually, from a scientific perspective, is not just an abundance of food, but an abundance at an optimal level. I mean, from a scientific perspective, I can't think of any way God could make the planet any more productive for the human species than the way he has done it. In terms of rainfall patterns, I mean, isn't it incredible that the way the climates are designed, we can grow food over almost all the planet? You say, well, what about the Sahara Desert? Well, the Sahara Desert is man's making. There was a tiny Sahara Desert before we human beings started abusing the North African continent. But it's the biggest desert on the planet. But it was a desert that, before human beings got involved, was no bigger than what we have here in California in our Mojave Desert. And in the days of the Roman Empire, the days in which this was being spoken of, where did Rome get all of its food? It got it from what is now the Sahara Desert. That was the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. Today, it's producing hardly anything at all. And even now, the Sahara Desert expands by 6 miles per year. Every year, the border, the southern border of the Sahara Desert, goes southward by 6 miles. So it's getting bigger at an enormous rate. Yes. Well, what occurred was people were over-cultivating the Sahara region, trying to grow too much food on it in too short of a period of time. And that leached the soil, and they were taking more water out than the water wasn't being returned, and that caused it to expand. They were cutting down the trees. They say, what's causing the Sahara Desert to advance today? Basically, they're cutting down the trees. And say, why are people cutting down trees? They're cutting down trees to cook. So it's the search for cooking fuel that's causing the Sahara Desert to advance as rapidly. And that's been going on for a whole century. So there's been a 600-mile advance in the last 100 years, essentially generated by the shortage of firewood for cooking. Yes. There was overgrazing that took place. So, okay. Acts. But, you know, keep in mind, this was Paul's first statement in trying to get the evangelistic message across. Is we, all of us, really can't doubt the existence of God because of what we see in terms of his provision for the human species. And the whole point is the human species is provided more for by the largesse of planet Earth than any other species. It seems like all of the planet is targeted towards giving a provision for us. Yes. Right. Now, it is reversible. This is something the Israelis have demonstrated in the land of Palestine, is that, when the Jews first came into the land, virtually the entire area was a desert. And you've heard the story. The Jews made the desert bloom. How did they make the desert bloom? They planted trees. Now, to start off with, they had to plant the trees far apart. And they basically would collect water into basins around the tree. They would actually dig out places and put the tree in the bottom of the hole so water would collect there. And by that means, they were able to make a tree, a fruit tree, productive with only 4 inches of rain. Because that 4 inches of rain would collect into the roots of the tree. And then once those fruit trees got a hold, that created a foliage which actually increased the rainfall. And then after that, they were able to plant pine trees and plant them more and more densely. Bottom line is, the highlands of Palestine have more than double the rainfall they had 100 years ago. And so, technically, we could reverse what's happened in the Sahara Desert. But the problem is you've got people that are desperate for firewood, so they keep cutting down the trees. Right. Right. Well, I think you've been to Nepal. I mean, another thing they're doing is they're burning all the manure that are produced by the animals. Manure that used to go back into the soil is now being used as a fuel. So, yes. Right. Right. So we're trying to wonder why it's not as productive as what God made it. We need to point the finger at ourselves. Okay. God made it much more productive than it is today. So, okay. Any more comments? Yes. No, no. Let's move on. Acts 17. Okay, this is the second evangelistic message by the Apostle Paul. And in fact, if you look at Paul's evangelistic messages in the book of Acts and in the epistles, you notice he always starts off with a statement that persuades his audience. There's a God out there, and it's not the God that you're following. It's a God that's much bigger than what you think. That's how he begins each of these evangelistic messages. But for this particular audience, he uses a different argument. Now, for the first audience, he says, look at the magnitude of God's provision. It can't be explained unless there's a God out there that's very powerful and very kind and loving and generous towards the human species. In this case, he starts off his evangelistic message by saying, God determined the time set for men and the exact places where they should live. God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him. Now, that's an interesting way to start an evangelistic message. Say, you know, the time in which you live was predetermined by God. The place in which you live has been predetermined by God. Now, what Paul is trying to get his audience to think about this is that for every one of us, and every one of us in this room, the time that you were born and the location in which you were raised and where you are right now and the time is no accident. And the point that Paul is trying to get across is to get these people meditating and saying, you know what? I really am living at an optimal time and an optimal place for me. And if that's true of me, maybe it's true of others. And if that's true, that can't be an accident. God must be doing this on purpose. This is also a theme we see in Genesis chapter 10 and 11. It's kind of backwards. Genesis 11 actually talks about events before Genesis 10. Genesis 11 verses 1 through 11 discuss that time after the Noahic flood when all of humanity, instead of obeying the command God gave to Noah, multiply and fill the earth, the same command he gave to Adam. And Adam's descendants didn't obey it, and Noah's descendants were having difficulty obeying it. And instead of multiplying and filling the earth, they said, let's build a city and a nation and a tower so we can stay in one place and not be scattered over the face of the earth. And God saw this as a prescription for a repeat of the evil that took place in the days before the flood, and so he purposely scattered humanity over the face of the earth. And Genesis 10 talks about this divine scattering, how God sent people out of Mesopotamia into pre-designated locations. And he actually documents or describes the different nations that God had sent different people groups to. Well, I don't think we've talked about this in a class before, but if you ever look at a geographical map, look at a map of the entire globe, the thing that's interesting about that, looking at the globe, is that God has designed the continents in such a way that it's relatively easy for people to move from one place to all the places of the world. Particularly easy in the time of which Genesis 10 and 11 are written. Because in the time in which Genesis 10 and 11 were written, there were bridges, land bridges, joining all the continents. Now, I'm not talking Antarctica. That's the exception. Okay? But Australia, North and South America, Europe, Asia, and Africa were all joined by land bridges. There was a land bridge, for example, that connected France to Britain. And so people didn't have to swim to get across to Britain. They could walk to get across. More than that, the land bridge that joined North America to Asia not only was 500 miles wide, for 3,000 years it was warm. Now, it was also warm at the moment that God scattered humanity over the face of the earth. There was only a 3,000-year window in which that Bering land bridge was warm. Warm enough that it provided plentiful seed grains all the way across, which means it would have been easy for people to migrate out of Asia into North and South America. Yes. That was occurring between 11 and 14,000 years ago. That's when the Bering Bridge was its widest and warmest. They say how warm? Average temperature of 56 degrees. Warm enough that wheat would grow and barley and oats and rice and sufficient. In fact, they've recovered large quantities of wild rice and wheat from that region, documenting that when people were moving across the bridge, there's plentiful food all the way. And this is kind of in concert with what we see in Acts 14. And the scientific evidence, by the way, documents that the human migration from one location throughout the entire planet, except for Antarctica, occurred in about a 1,000-year window. We're talking a very rapid migration of humanity from one place. You say, how was this achieved? Well, there were pre-designed, from a Christian perspective, escape routes out of Mesopotamia. What do I mean by pre-designed escape routes? For example, scientists have discovered there was a very rapid human migration that took place from the Gulf around the continental shore all the way into India and China and Japan. In other words, what happened is human beings simply took the route of migrating along the seashore over that huge distance of thousands of miles. And likewise, how did people get from the Bering Strait in Alaska all the way down to the south tip of South America? Again, they did it by walking along the seashore. And I say, what do we notice about seashores? Well, I happen to grow up on the British Columbia seashore. That's where I would go. And I remember as a kid that my dad would take us to have a family day. And that's what we would do on Labor Day. We would go to the beach. However, we would not take any food. And we wouldn't take any firewood. Why? Because it was right there on the beach. We would go to this beach, and there'd be berries all along the side of the beach. And there was wild vegetables you could pick. And then you would go down to the beach, and there was oysters and clams you just pick up right off the sand. And then we would have a fishing rod, and we would catch something just casting it out. And, at least when I was a kid in British Columbia, virtually every cast got you a fish. And then there was all kinds of driftwood on the beach, so we'd gather the driftwood, start a fire, and we would eat these clams and oysters and fish and berries and wild vegetables. And that's one of the things I appreciate about my dad. He taught me how to gather up all this free food. So but it was good food, too. Well, I think you can see how that would facilitate a very rapid migration. You don't have to carry a lot of stuff on your back. The wood is there. The food is there. All you got to do is keep walking. So, yeah. Yes, this was at the end of the Ice Age, the last Ice Age. And what happens with an Ice Age is you get ice being transferred from the Arctic Ocean into northern Canada, well, all of Canada, actually, and Siberia. And that ice piling up on Siberia and Canada actually works to push those continents down. Okay, and when you push the continents down, the seafloor that separates them gets pushed up. And then you also have a lot of water being taken out of the oceans and turned into continental ice. So that causes the sea level to drop. So the combination of the dropping of the sea level and the pressure on the continental land masses that forces other regions, the seafloor, to come up, actually resulted in a net increase in height of the bottom of the Bering Strait of 500 feet. And that 500 feet uplift, net uplift, if you take into account the sea level drop, actually created a land bridge about 500 miles wide. What would account for the warmer temperature? Cycles of the Earth's orbit. In fact, we're coming into another ice age because our warm period should be over soon. And in fact, it's human activity that's delaying the onset of the next ice age. So in one sense, you can say global warming is a good thing. It's put off the next ice age. However, there is a limit to how long we can put off the next ice age. And what drives is the fact that as the Earth orbits around the Sun, its elliptical shape of its orbit changes. And so, the Earth has a slightly elliptical orbit, very slightly, but the degree of ellipticity varies over a 41,000-year cycle, pardon me, 100,000-year cycle. And so when it becomes more elliptical rather than less elliptical, this causes causes colder temperatures in the wintertime and therefore more ice accumulation. The other thing that happens is the tilt of the Earth's orbit varies with a 41,000-year cycle. And so you have these 41,000-year patterns and 100,000-year patterns. And it's such that in the era in which we live, it generates an ice age about every 100,000 years. And if you go back far enough in the past, a couple of million years ago, we were getting an ice age every 41,000 years. So depending what part of the Earth's orbital history you're in, you get ice ages every 100,000 years or ice ages every 41,000 years. No, I'm not saying it's going to be within your lifespan. Soon on a 100,000-year cycle would be... Although I can... There's a paper I think I shared here in the class about 8 months ago where I made the point that an atmospheric physicist had documented that we are now 5,000 years overdue for an ice age. If it wasn't for human activity, we would have been in an ice age for the last 5,000 years. And so there's been this global benign climate that we have now sustained for over 10,000 years. And, you know, typically you don't sustain it that long. And this paper actually documented why the Ice Age hasn't happened already. And the three things that have forestalled the Ice Age are we've domesticated cows, and by domesticating cows, we've significantly increased methane in the atmosphere. We've virtually doubled the amount of methane in the atmosphere. And methane is a far more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And the other thing that we have done is we've domesticated rice to the point where we're using irrigation as a primary tool for increasing the productivity of rice. But with rice irrigation, you have the decay of the rice stalks after you harvest as methane. So the combination of rice and cows has almost doubled the methane in the atmosphere. The other thing that we've done, pardon me? I think he's still busy inventing the internet, so. That's why I call them algorithms. All right, thank you. I'm even going to use that one. That's a good one. So, now the other thing we've done is we've been cutting down trees. We've been talking about the Sahara Desert. When you cut down trees, what that does is it stops the carbon dioxide being consumed from the atmosphere and converted into sugars, starches, and fats. And so the combination of those three, turning forests into pastures, rice, and cows, has forestalled the Ice Age. Now, the basis of this paper, though, is to make an alarming point, is that now that we're burning fossil fuels at the rate we are, we're actually going to forestall the Ice Age another few hundred years, but makes the point, when we run out of fossil fuels, we will catastrophically drop into an Ice Age. Because what the fossil fuel burning is doing is significantly warming the planet, but when we run out, we'll be so far into the Ice Age cycle that the cows and the cutting down of trees and the rice will not rescue us. Because if you look at the cycle, you know, every 100 years you delay it, you're actually into a more aggressive cooling trend of the planet. And so he says within 400 years, we're looking at a very quick drop into a severe Ice Age. But, you know, well, the thing about fossil fuel burning is that right now we're consuming about 1 million years worth of stored carbon every year. And so, I mean, you can't really replace that just by growing more corn. Because, you know, and that's the point of this whole paper, is that the rate at which we're burning fossil fuels is significantly enhancing the temperature of the planet. But his whole point is, look what's going to happen when we run out. Because now we'll no longer have any means to put off this Ice Age. Well, I mean, I would argue, I mean, the reason why I say 400 years, because when people look at the Middle East, they say 60 years. But the reason why I'm saying 400 is that actually the greatest oil reserves are not in the Middle East. They're in North America. It's the United States and Canada that's sitting on the greatest treasure trove of fossil fuels. However, they're in a form that's hard to process, tar sands and shales. Tar sands and shales. The United States has got the world's greatest resource of shales. Canada has got the world's greatest resource of tar sands. Venezuela's got some tar sands too, but nothing like what exists in Canada. It's such that because we're paying $3 a gallon at the pump, the tar sands are economic. And the U.S. today is getting 1 million gallons a day from the Canadian tar sands. And the Canadians are wanting to push it up to 4 million gallons a day because the Chinese want a bunch. So the Chinese are going to get some, Americans are going to get some. But the truth is there is about 8 times as much oil in the Athabasca tar sands as there is in all of the Middle East. Well, the whole point, you know what's delayed? I have friends in Alberta. That's where my dad came from, is the province of Alberta. What is causing them to be a little bit frightened is they know that the Saudis, for example, can put them out of business anytime they want, because the Saudis can get oil out of the ground very cheaply. And the only way those Canadian tar sands can be economic is if the price at the pump stays above $2 a gallon. If it ever drops below $2 a gallon, they will be run out of business. And so, the Saudis are in a position to make that happen short term. You know, for 20, 30 years, they can wipe out the Canadian oil industry. So, but the Canadians are thinking, because the Chinese want so much oil, we don't really have to worry about the Saudis pumping all their cheap oil out of the ground. So, and then the Americans are thinking, we're not sure the Chinese should get all that. We really want it here. So there's competition. Meanwhile, the shales are not being exploited. Why? Because the shales require a price at about $3.50 to $4 a gallon to be economic. And so, you know, there's all that shale sitting in Colorado and Wyoming, but as long as the Canadians are working on their tar sands, why bother to pull that stuff out of the ground? Yes. This is a little bit off the topic of X, isn't it? Yes. Well, there's enough in this sense, in that if you look at a map of North and South America, you notice there are coastal mountains all the way down. And with coastal mountains, with snowpack, you're going to have streams coming off those mountains. So, for example, when I grew up in coastal British Columbia, you only really had to walk a mile to find the next waterfall. So the water was there, lots of fresh water. And that was a wonderful thing about growing up in British Columbia. You could spend the day at the beach, and you didn't have to take anything with you. There was fire there. There was all this food. Now, we'll tell you the one negative. Often, my dad would take us to the beach, and it would pour rain all day. And so he would... And he'd say, son, this is how you survive under these circumstances. First thing you do is you build a lean-to. I says, oh, great, a lean-to where I can stay. No, he says, no. A lean-to is for the fire. Okay, you build a lean-to, and he showed me how to, you know, put that lean-to up, and you put all these pine needles and stuff over it so that underneath the lean-to, it was dry. And then you'd start a fire underneath this lean-to. Of course, it would burn up the lean-to, but now you got a fire going. And once you got the fire going, then you build a lean-to for the people. And the whole point is you go out and gather these oysters and clams and fish and so forth and berries, and you run back to the lean-to where you can dry off and get warm at the fire. So that's how you'd make it. But, you know, I imagine that people living 10 to 15,000 years ago could easily figure that out. It wasn't that difficult. I mean, you just kind of walk along the beach, and you can quickly figure out, oh, there's food there, and there's firewood here, and there's water coming off the mountains, and... So it doesn't take a whole lot of... But the whole point is, and this is the point that Paul has made here, I mean, why is it so easy to migrate those long distances at that speed? And why did God design the continents the way they do? Keep in mind, those continents are moving. It's only at this juncture in history that we got the continents oriented in such a way that you've got water separating them all. And by the way, that's critical. If you don't have this feature where you've got these big land masses with huge oceans in between them, you're not going to get even waterfall over the whole planet. I mean, what if you just have one big land mass with a huge ocean around it? Well, you'll get water falling around the edges, but you're not going to get a whole lot in the middle. Well, the continents are designed in such a way that virtually everybody gets a decent rainfall so that they can grow crops. Well, that's not an accident. We just have to be living at that time in history when the continents have the appropriate sizes and separation from one another in terms of the way the oceans are set up. And the other thing that's interesting is notice that the continents have shapes that present north-south boundaries. Okay, that's not an accident either. The continents have these north-south boundaries. What does that do? That creates a boundary to the prevailing winds. The planets rotating like this, east-west, and the continents are oriented north-south, and so that means that you've got wind blowing over the water, picking up moisture, hits the land masses and drops the water, so the people have water so that they can grow these crops. And again, he has shown us the kindness by giving you rain from heaven. Well, the rain that we get from heaven, as it points out in the book of Job, is not an accident. The rain that falls from heaven has been optimally designed to provide an abundance of provision for humanity. Now, I'm kind of giving you a 21st century perspective on this, but I would argue even 2,000 years ago, the scientists of that day, knowing as much as they did about weather patterns and so forth, could come to the same conclusion we've come today. This is no accident. This has all been designed on the part of the Creator so that we would have this abundance of food, so that we would not only have food to eat, but food that would bring us joy. I mean, I didn't make that point when we were talking about Acts 14. But from a naturalistic perspective, I could imagine that, yeah, you would have plants that would produce a minimal amount of food, and we would have to work hard to gather that food because the plants only produce barely a bit more than what they need themselves. And what if all that food tasted exactly the same? Now, from a naturalist, are you bearing out? But what does we see here? He gives you plenty of food and fills your hearts with joy. I mean, what do people do when they want to socialize? They get together for food. In fact, I'll bet you there's a number of you in this class that are planning some kind of food celebration this weekend, right? Barbecue or whatever. But the whole point is this brings us joy because the food has such variety, has such abundance, and it's fun to eat that stuff and talk to one another as we eat. It didn't have to be that way. What if all the food we ate tasted like cardboard? How motivated would we be to have our friends come over and join us for a meal if all the food we ate tasted like cardboard? It could be nutritious and so forth, but what if it all just didn't bring us this amount of joy? Yes. I think you're absolutely right that this, even though we have way more scientific proof of the truth of these verses than what existed in the days of the Apostle Paul, because we are more distant from the land and trying to provide for a family by taking what we can from the land, we miss these points. I don't think it's an accident that virtually all the atheists on this planet live in big cities. Okay? They get their food from the supermarket. They don't go to the beach and see all this provision that's sitting out there. Or do they go to the beaches of California where there's such a huge population that everything's been picked up already? I mean, that's the thing that hit me when I first came to California in 1973. I went to the beach and I didn't see any driftwood at all. Whereas in British Columbia, the driftwood is piled up about 12 feet high. Here, there's nothing. What's happened? A little bit of driftwood hits the beach, somebody picks up and takes it home. And that's where I saw all the driftwood, was in people's living rooms. It's not on the beach, it gets picked up. Yes. Well, there's a lot of debate about civilizations in North and South America in the Neolithic era. Because, you know, what we read about in the textbooks are the Incas and the Aztecs. Well, those are the civilizations that were the most advanced at the time when we found, you know, white men came to North America. Years ago, as opposed to what was going on 2,000 and 3,000 years ago. So in that sense, I don't think it's fair to say that there was only civilization going on, say, in Mexico and Peru. Chances are it was all over the place, but it just kind of moved around. And, you know, one thing that I think we need to be aware of is that when the Europeans, peoples, hog off the land, in other words, North America and South America to a lesser degree, life was easy. It wasn't like it was in Europe, Africa, and Asia. I mean, you know, what motivation do you have to plant a garden if all you got to do is go down to the beach and take everything you want? I mean, you know, and the climate's good all year. I mean, so the fact that there's this plentiful provision that's there all the time really explains why the Indians never developed technology. On the other hand, there's another explanation for why the Indians never really developed technology. They wound up eating off all the horses and camels and elephants. So horses and cattle played a big role in launching civilization in Europe, Asia, and Africa. But the first humans that came into North and South America wound up slaughtering off all the horses and the camels. There was lions, tigers, horses, and camels in abundance, and elephants here in North and South America. And within about 1,000 years, they were all gone. So in that sense, there was an over-harvesting that went on that made it difficult for the Indians to develop any technology. Notice what happened to the Indians once they got horses. But without horses, life was a little more challenging for them. Yeah, over here. That's right. Well, there's been civilizations that they've uncovered in Brazil, on the coast of Brazil, that dates back about 8,000 years ago. Down in southern Chile, they found some evidence. And the Queen Charlotte Islands evidently had some kind of written history that dated back about 11,000 years ago. You know where the Alaskan Panhandle is? If you go just south of the Alaskan Panhandle, you have these large islands called the Queen Charlotte Islands. And they're about 60 to 80 miles off the coast of British Columbia, completely isolated. And the Haida Indians lived there. And they would build these villages of what they called longhouses, which were quite sophisticated structures, about the size of our large auditoriums. Yes. Time frame of the Tower of Babel is difficult to pin down. I mean, what we've done in, it's actually in creationist science, but you'll also see it in our book, Who is Adam? Is that we tried to calibrate the Genesis 5 and 11 genealogies. And what you see in Genesis 11 is a list of names between Noah and Abraham. And for Abraham, you have a good historical date from the biblical source, but also there's extra-biblical archaeological finds that allow us to date when Abraham lived. And the answer is he lived about 4,000 years ago, plus or minus 50 years. And then we have a carbon 14 date for when Peleg lived. Peleg's halfway down the genealogy, and in Genesis 10:25, it tells us the world was divided in the days of Peleg. Now, if that refers, as I believe it does, to the breaking of the Bering Land Bridge, we can use the carbon 14 dating for the breaking of that Bering Land Bridge to pinpoint when Peleg lived. And the answer comes out to 11,000 years ago, plus or minus 100 years. So now you've got two dates in which you can calibrate the Genesis 11 genealogy. Now, what we do in those two books is we make the assumption that the lifespans recorded in the text are proportional to the passage of time. Now, you might say that assumption could be wrong, and I say, yeah, but that's the only assumption you can go with to get any kind of possible calibration. We do know that the genealogies are not complete. There are gaps in the genealogy. So if those lifespans are proportional to the passage of time, that gives you an approximate date for Noah and the flood in the neighborhood of 30,000 years ago. And you say, how approximate? I would only be comfortable in saying 30 plus or minus 10. So somewhere between 20 and 40,000 years ago, you would have the flood of Noah. And if you use that calibration on the Genesis 5 genealogy, it would put the creation of Adam and Eve somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 60,000 years ago. Now, one reason why we feel comfortable with that calibration is it gives us a date for the creation of Adam and Eve that's consistent with the genetic dates we have for the first man and the first woman. Those dates are coming in at 50,000 years ago. Likewise, the Big Bang of clothing use and jewelry use comes in at about 50,000 years ago. So in that sense, we got a consistent picture there. So all the text tells us it happened sometime between the flood and the building of six cities in the plain and the scattering of humanity. Now, in order for to explain those six cities of the plain and the building of the Tower of Babel, you're going to need a few generations. And the biblical text records at least four generations between the flood of Noah and the building of the Tower of Babel. But there could be a lot more than four generations. It just mentions those four. So it could be a few thousand years. It's certainly at least, I would say, 500 years. But probably more like a few thousand years, maybe more, for the Tower of Babel incident. In terms of the scattering of humanity, the evidence for the most dramatic scattering is in the neighborhood of 10 to 30,000 years ago. Australia got settled very quickly. North and South America was the last settled place. Australia was settled by 30,000 years ago. However, that would be a very easy migration route because you're going from the Persian Gulf along the south shore of Asia down into Australia, and you've got warm weather all the way, and you've got a seashore all the way. And by the way, it would have been easier 30,000 years ago than today, because 30,000 years ago, you had many more species of life that would be suitable for providing for humanity than we have today. As you read in David's Psalms, there were bears, lions, and tigers in the land of Israel. Today, you won't find a bear, tiger, or lion anywhere in that region or anywhere in most of Asia. But back at the time of the migration, we could presume that there would be much more plentiful provision there is today, and therefore a very rapid migration. Now, the migration in North and South America had to wait until there was a warm bridge. There was a cold bridge in place as far back as 40,000 years ago. So the Bering Bridge was there from 40,000 years ago to 11,000 years ago, but only became warm enough for easy migration 14,000 years ago. So those are kind of the dates that would flesh all this out. And right now, there's a furious effort to determine the exact migration patterns and timings through genetic means. But the remarkable thing is this, is that in the scientific literature, they're actually pressuring the National Science Foundation to fund this immediately, because within 10 years, this research will be impossible to do. Right now, it can be done. 10 years from now, it won't be possible to do it. Why? Because the genetic research must be done on stable populations. Populations where you've got people that have been in one place literally for dozens, if not hundreds, of generations. And now there's a danger that populations will become so thoroughly mixed, we will not be able to do those genetic studies. In fact, already, the genetic research is not as of high quality as it was 10 years ago because of the migrations of people. So, and the scoop in the scientific community is that the government is going to be too stingy to fund the necessary research that we'll be able to get it before the window of opportunity closes forever. So, yeah, you know, go to Paul Allen for that one, right? So forget about looking for intelligent life in outer space. Let's see if we can check out the history of human migration. Well, we're excited about it. Fuzz and I are excited about it because this is a marvelous way to put to the test what the Bible says about human origins and human migration. And already we've come up with a significant confirmation. The Bible claims there is this rapid human migration, and the genetic evidence indeed is proving that that took place. And that can't be explained unless there's some external factor driving the human migration. And the biblical text says God is the one that stepped in and forced this migration. And a forced migration, you can anticipate, would be rapid. But the point we're making here in Acts 17, that's not only rapid, it's pre-designed. God had pre-designed the planet in such a way that there would be these places that we could go. And, you know, one application I want to make before we close this up, we've only got a few minutes left, is that this is not just true for nations. The point I was making, look at a map. Everything's designed to facilitate migration, but there's another level of design we see when we look at this map of the world. The continents are enriched with mountain barriers and rivers and deserts and jungles in such a way as to provide natural boundaries for nations to live so that one nation can't dominate all other nations. Now, this is being overcome by modern technology. But for thousands of years, the geography of planet Earth was ideally optimized so that nations could have natural boundaries that would be defensible against other nations that would be bordering them. However, the boundaries were not so high in terms of their geography that it would cut those people off forever. They could easily communicate with the neighboring nations. Nevertheless, the natural boundaries there were sufficiently defensible that it would make it difficult for any one nation to dominate all the nations of the world. And so I think this is one thing Paul is talking about, is that God actually created geography, places in which the different nations can live, where they could live in relative safety, but also live not just in safety from neighboring governments, but their own government. Now, to me, it's amazing that this planet Earth has been designed in such a way that we have geography set up in such a manner that if the government, the nation in which I live, starts oppressing me, I can leave that nation and live in the neighboring nation. I can cross the boundary and say, well, it's a different language. And that's the other thing we notice. It says in the text that God gave all these languages. Notice that the language barriers are not so high that it would intimidate you from leaving your mother tongue and adopting a second tongue. But they're high enough that you think twice about it. I mean, for me to leave California and go to Japan and learn Japanese and function in Japanese society, I can tell you right now, having been to Japan four times, that barrier is high enough, I won't do it. Okay? Unless things get very oppressive here in the United States. They have to get very oppressive before I'd be willing to do it. Now, going to Mexico is another matter, because there the language barrier isn't that high. It's not that difficult. There's much separation between English and Spanish. But the whole point is, these languages we have seem to be optimally designed. They're designed in such a way as to provide a level of separation amongst the nations, but they're also designed in such a way that if things get oppressive, we can overcome that and make it work. And likewise, the geographical barriers are optimally designed. And Paul's point here is this is no accident. The fact that we have these places, these locations, and these times in which we can live, and notice the timing too. The timing is such that the geography works out that there are times when one nation may be predominant, economically productive, and beneficial for its citizens, but it's not permanent. The United States will not be the wealthiest nation of planet Earth indefinitely. I can say that with confidence because that's the way it's been throughout human history. Britain was not the best nation to live on planet Earth indefinitely. It was a time when God had blessed Great Britain, but I don't think we can say that Great Britain is the most blessed nation on the planet today. It was for a while. And every nation gets its turn. There are set times and set places, but the thing I'd like to close with here, this is even true on an individual basis. I mean, I would just challenge each one of you to examine yourself and see whether or not God caused you to be born at the right time and to live in the right place. And if you've moved a lot like I have, to recognize that those moves are not accidents. God was behind each move. I'm old enough now where I can look back on my life and say, every time I made a move, I was born in Montreal, and my father took me all the way across Montreal, and we went to Vancouver. And I can tell you in hindsight, that was a tremendous blessing. I wouldn't be here today if my dad hadn't lost his business when I was 4 years of age, and his reputation was ruined in the city of Montreal, and he was forced to locate in Vancouver. I can say that with confidence because looking back in hindsight, I realize my education, if I had stayed in Montreal, would have been quite inferior to the education I got being raised in an immigrant suburb of Vancouver. I mean, I was raised in a place that was nothing but refugees. But these refugees were typically people of a very high intellectual caliber, and I got to go to a public school. There was only 1,000 people in our high school. It covered 6 grades. Each grade had just less than 200 in it. Yet we graduated 6 of the top students in the entire province. Why? Because our population was basically people who'd escaped from all these oppressive countries all over the world, and who were the ones getting out and settling in Vancouver? Basically members of the intelligentsia. So I had the privilege of going to school with these people, and not only that, the school in which I attended, the school officials realized that they had this talented student body, and so they recruited the top teachers in the city to teach us. So I was blessed with terrific teachers when I was in high school. Now, all that happened because my dad lost his business when I was 4 years of age. And then I went from Vancouver to Toronto for my graduate education. And I can tell you in hindsight that it was a good thing I turned down the offer at the University of Washington. I could have gone there. I had an offer to go to UCLA. I turned that down. I wound up going to the University of Toronto. And in hindsight, I can recognize that was a tremendous blessing. Why? Because the University of Toronto at that time, not anymore, but at that time said, we're going to set up a situation where we combine the best of European science education with the best of American science education, which meant that we had to take all the courses the Americans had to take, but our thesis had to be at the quality of the level of the Europeans. And, you know, we had to work a lot harder, but in hindsight, I can recognize that prepared me for what I'm doing right now. And likewise, I can't think of anything better than the fact that I wound up here in Southern California. Caltech was a tremendous experience for me. But again, I would just challenge you. Look at your own life. Look at all the moves that have taken place throughout your life. Look at the timing of your birth. Let me just say something about the timing of my birth. I was born in 1945. And I tell my boys that I'm a post-war baby by only a few days. The atomic bomb had fallen before I was born. However, it had not fallen in Hiroshima. So I was born between Alamogordo and in Hiroshima. That's true. Well, that's the whole point. I was conceived during the war. But in Canada, much more so the United States, virtually every able-bodied man was sent overseas. Of all my uncles, and I have a lot of uncles on both sides of the family, you know, my dad was the only male that stayed in Canada during the war. The rest of them fought overseas. And my dad would tell me stories about when he was dating my mother and taking my mother out on a date, how he had to take another dozen women with him on the date because there just were no men in the city of Montreal. And so it was really difficult trying to date your mother because of the fact I had all these other women around too at the same time. There just weren't any men around. Well, the only men that were in Canada at that time and conceiving children were men that were considered to be of such a talented level that they were not permitted to enlist. My dad was not allowed to enlist because he had all this engineering ability. And so he spent the war designing hydraulic systems for fighter aircraft. But as a result, I wound up going to school and university. But the thing they told me when I was at the University of British Columbia, the kids that were born in 44 and 45 have an IQ level on the average that's 30 points above anything before 44 and anything after 45. So again, well, why? Because, you know, who was having children during that era? The only people having children were those people that were of such a talented nature that they were not allowed to enlist in the armed forces. They had to stay home and, you know, design all this stuff. And they sent the dummies off to war, right? So, while Canada, for example, with a population of only 10 million, had 1.2 million men in uniform. So that meant that, you know, young women, men that would normally be having children, it didn't happen. My uncles, for example, had their families after the war. My dad was the only one that was having children during the war. But, you know, you can imagine going to a class where everybody is born in, say, 45, and, you know, just the kind. And, you know, we thought that was normal. And the other thing I noted, too, is that our professor said, we have a talented bunch of students here. You know how many classroom lecture hours I went through when I was in my senior year, undergraduate? 38 lecture hours. Now, they had a rule in Canada that nobody could take more than 18 units. The physics department said, well, we're going to give you 18 units for 38 classroom hours. That's the way it's going to be. And, you know, we all put up with it because we wanted the education. And so we literally worked our tails off because, you know, it was 38 hours, plus you had to do at least double that and study afterwards. But in hindsight, we've recognized we have an education that's unique because of the fact of, you know, the time in which we were born. Well, I'm not saying there's anything special about my year. It's special for me. You know, because of, you know, who I am, that was really ideal for me. Now, I'm just saying for each one of you, consider the time in which you're born. Consider the place in which you're born. Consider the fact that God put you in a place where you came into contact with people that are able to guide you into this Christian faith and hence into an eternal relationship with Jesus Christ. I bet every one of you here, as a Christian, will recognize that God put people in your life at just the right time and just the right place. I didn't meet Christians until I came to Caltech. If I had gone to Britain, I was thinking of going to Cambridge for my postdoctoral research. If I had gone to Cambridge instead of Caltech, I would have probably gone many more years before meeting believers. Not only that, at Caltech, I met believers who were involved in Christian ministry, evangelism, and missions. They were the ones that told me about this church and got me going to this church. And, you know, things were different back then. The church isn't the same as it was back then. But I can tell you, that turned my life around. Christianity is very difficult to live out if you're not in contact with other believers. And I have a tremendous appreciation today for what Christian fellowship is all about, because I went the first 8 years of my Christian life without any Christian fellowship. You say, how could that happen? Well, in Canada, try finding a church that's decent if you don't know any Christians. I went into a lot of churches. Every church I tried was either a church where the people, including the pastors, did not believe the Bible was the Word of God. I said, well, it's a waste of time my going to this place, so I would stop going. And I said, I need to find a place where people are actually fervent about their belief in God and the Bible. And I found a few churches that were like that. Every one of them was a cult. Now, it wasn't until I came to Caltech that I actually found churches that are vibrant and people that are excited about living the Christian faith and people who are excited about developing a level of morality and practicing that morality. My problem when I was at the University of Toronto is I thought my morality was really good because I compared it against all the pagans around me, okay? And so when I came to Caltech and realized, wow, God's setting a standard here, not here. And this is exciting. I need to get involved and, you know, come pull up my socks and so forth. Well, again, I challenge each one of you. Think back in your life, and I'll bet you'll be able to recall how God brought people into your life that you did not expect Him to bring into your life. And those people that factor in turning your life around. And when I travel on the road, I see that all the time. You know, the places where I go, I meet people that I know is not an accident. Every meeting has been pre-planned. Every person you meet in your life has been pre-designed by this Creator. And I think that's what the Apostle Paul is getting at here when he said, God determined the time set for men and the exact places where they should live. God did this so that men would seek Him and perhaps reach out to Him and find Him, making the point, my life is not an accident. If my life is not an accident, there must be God out there. I'm 8 minutes over. Let me close. Father in heaven, Father, it's exciting to think about just how much in control of each of our lives You are. Father, I pray we would spend this Labor Day weekend just meditating over what You've done in each of our lives. Father, to get us set on the path that You've chosen for us. Sometimes we stumble around the dark having no idea what's going on. But Father, You are in control. You are in control of every minute that goes on in our life. Every place that we go has been chosen by you before the creation of the universe. Father, I pray that you would reveal to each one of us the miracles that you have performed to put us in the place where you want us, so that we can fulfill the purpose you set for us, not for others, but the purpose you set for us. Thank you about the manner in which you created us and designed us. We were formed in our mother's wombs, and at that time, you were designing and shaping us for a particular path and purpose in our life. Father, I pray you'd help each one of us to continue to discover exactly what else there is that you want us to do in these few years we have here on this planet. And Lord, give us the opportunity to communicate with people who don't know you as Lord and Savior, that their lives, likewise, are not an accident. And there's a God out there that has been working.